This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. In the weeks since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, many states have issued abortion bans and restrictions, like the Ohio law that's become infamous, forcing a 10-year-old victim of rape to travel out of state. At the same time, many governors and legislatures have acted to protect reproductive rights. And with no federal law above them, we may see neighboring states in direct conflict over the right to travel for an abortion. New Mexico's governor, Michelle Lujan Grisham, has declared her state a reproductive safe haven between Arizona and Texas. Days after the Dobbs decision, she issued an executive order to protect New Mexico's abortion providers from legal action by those other states. Lujan Grisham represented New Mexico in the Congress for 3 terms, and she was elected governor in 2018. Governor, I think we knew that the decision from the Supreme Court was coming once the opinion leaked, but I would love to know what your reaction was on the day it did come out, and what has it been like in your office?
I think like most Americans, and polling is certainly showing that, I woke up to that decision and you're sick to your stomach because we humans hang on to, you know, whatever piece of potential hope. But frankly, we've been preparing for that ultimate decision by this Supreme Court in New Mexico for more than a year, because the risks in this national political debate about our constitutional rights to privacy and a constitutional right to reproductive care, abortion, and abortion care has been the subject of such angst and anger and misinformation in this country for longer than just the last several months.
Well, you say you have been preparing at the State House and in your office. How did you prepare? What plans did you make?
Well, the first thing that we did is we had an antiquated criminalization of abortion statute on the books. Never had been used. Frankly, I would say that most providers, most attorneys, and certainly most New Mexicans had no idea that it existed. So we actually, in 2019, I tried to repeal it right after I was elected, and I failed by just a couple of votes. And we finally got it done. And we did that a year before this ultimate decision by the Supreme Court. And we invested in more family planning, more access to contraceptives, in addition to our core family planning access points like public health, school-based health centers, making sure it's readily available through your physicians, our physician access programs, all of our infectious disease and public health harm reduction. All those investments have all been targeted to improve our public health outcomes related to the potential that Roe v. Wade was always at risk.
Governor, New Mexico is a blue state situated between Texas and Arizona. You even share a bit of a border with Oklahoma as well. They all have abortion bans of some kind, and they're all quite conservative. Now, I don't think that the leaders of Texas and Arizona are going to be thrilled if you open more clinics and you refuse extradition. So, are you worried about reprisals from those states and their leaderships?
In this context, if you're not thinking or concerned about what could occur and being embattled in litigation, I think this is what the Supreme Court teed up. The first issue is that they have discriminated against women and other populations, including LGBTQ populations, and they are limiting healthcare access. Chilling, outrageous, discriminatory, and we should do everything in our power to do something about it. But the second thing that they've done is they've invited states now to fight with each other, sue each other, and create in a number of really harsh, I'm looking for the right word, the fact that another state, frankly, can try to sue a provider that's licensed here because they're also licensed in another state, challenging all of our current, right, insurance, certification, regulatory aspects for healthcare access in this country. Because in my view, they're trying to control women is the most disgusting and despicable aspect frankly, of this particular decision. It is inviting.
Can you imagine Texas? Forgive me.
I do. I imagine Texas and their attorney general. Look what's going on in Indiana. I absolutely imagine that we will have politicians for political gain on this issue in the most narrow manner who will prosecute and persecute women, children, their families, and providers, and to take that to the nth degree.
You anticipate Texas law enforcement, backed up by the politics and the politicians of Texas, possibly making arrests on women seeking abortions in New Mexico?
Certainly attempting. If I didn't think that, there would be no reason to have an executive order saying this is what we'll do to protect providers and patients and their families in New Mexico.
Governor, explain what was in the executive order.
The executive order was to, frankly, prepare the state and to make sure that government, state government, could not be used as a vehicle to support another state who would reach in here to prevent their citizens and residents from seeking abortion and abortion care in New Mexico, including that they would prosecute and, in my view, persecute then providers who are providing that access who might also have a license in their states. So as to make it clear that where we will cooperate, and we still will, on other real criminal actions where you do want to do extradition and cooperate, I don't consider this a criminal action. Neither does New Mexico.
So you envision the possibility of opening even more clinics?
I do.
How are clinics responding to this new reality? Because you are situated between and among states that are going to come down very hard on abortion, and I assume you're already seeing people coming from those states to New Mexico, to the few abortion clinics that you have.
We are. When you're a safe haven state, this is exactly the impact, which means you put real stress on your current provider system. And we are now seeing a situation where we have waiting lists.
What kind of politics have resulted in your policy and your reaction to Dobbs? What kind of opposition have you felt?
I haven't seen the same kind of opposition that we're seeing around the country. I've seen the opposite, you know, a rallying of support by most New Mexicans who were outraged by not only this decision, but quite frankly, the Clarence Thomas writing that said, look, as long as we're there, let's talk about privacy issues and well-settled law for other populations.
You are up for re-election. Your opponent in the race is a Republican named Mark Ronchetti, and he has said that 15 weeks should be the limit for abortion. So he's not an absolutist on this. He's not on the right wing on this spectrum. Would you support some limit or compromise, as he's suggesting?
No. There are far... If you really are in a situation where you are protecting women's privacy rights mm-hmm. and the relationship between their medical providers, my attitudes and my personal decisions and the government's have no bearing on those personal decisions. There is no question that I believe, like many Americans, that abortion should be rare. And the reason I believe that is because we should be doing more for violence, rape, domestic abuse, incest, underage, sexual activity, non-consensual, all of it. If we did better family planning and comprehensive sex education and made contraceptives more available and we were better at primary care access, then you get to the place where we should all be preventing unwanted, unexpected pregnancies. But to say that I can make a personal decision for women who currently do not have those options, particularly in states where they don't have access to contraceptives, well, that is outrageous to me.
Your state has the highest percentage of Latino voters of any state, and that's a demographic that's supported you quite heavily. But Latino voters in the state have tended not to support abortion rights in the majority. Is there a risk here for you and for the Democratic Party in the state of New Mexico?
Well, I don't think so. And in New Mexico, where we're a Hispanic majority, minority majority state, and I am certainly you're talking about 400 years. My family's in that same space. And many of us, not all of us, but many of us are Catholic and very clear about what the church says about abortion and abortion access and even contraceptives. But if you take a step back, even here in New Mexico, and given that we repealed our criminalization of abortion, most Hispanic families and women, most Hispanic men today do not want, so the majority of those voters do not want the government in this space.
So you don't see this hurting your chances for reelection?
I do not.
Just the opposite?
Just the opposite.
Governor, in the past few years, particularly coming in the midst of the Trump years and their aftermath, we have heard warnings about civil war of various kinds and degrees, and certainly something this country has experienced in the past. Are you concerned about political violence as you declare New Mexico a pro-choice state amidst Texas and Arizona, who are on the opposite side?
That's a really hard question, because I want to respond in this way, that we don't need to be concerned about that violence because New Mexico isn't going to tolerate that. But in fact, what we're seeing across the country and in some circumstances, even here, we know that the threats of violence are real, that we're seeing that tension escalate all across the country. And if I or anyone suggest that you shouldn't be concerned about it, it's an immature response. I'm hopeful that this is a state and other states that protect people, and that that protection and that recognition of your own civil rights and choices can create a space where we can have discourse about better solutions to public health issues. I mean, we are not talking in the context of the Dobbs decision, as I started in this interview, about child well-being and maternal health and poverty. I hope New Mexico can be a beacon for those investments and interventions, and that will create a better space for all Americans.
Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham of New Mexico, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Michelle Lujan Grisham is governor of New Mexico, and she's running for a second term in November. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
In a razor town, you'll take whoever you think you can keep around.
Jason Isbell got into the music business pretty early. So early that he had a music publishing deal by the time he was 21. At the same time, he joined the band Drive-By Truckers. But he really came into his own as a songwriter around 10 years ago, as he was getting sober from years of alcohol and drugs. The record was called Southeastern, and it swept the Americana Music Awards in 2014. Those songs have got it all. Great lyrics, great melodies, great stories, and more acclaimed records have followed.
I've been loving you.
Isbell's most recent is called Georgia Blue. It fulfilled a promise he made that if Joe Biden won the state in 2020, he'd make an album for charity of cover songs by Georgia artists. One of Isbell's great admirers is The New Yorker's John Seabrook. And John sat down with Jason Isbell at the New Yorker Festival in 2016 when the record Something More Than Free had just come out. And a little later in the program, we'll also hear some of Jason Isbell's music.
Thank you.
All right. How you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you.
You got your baby back in the hotel?
The baby's in the hotel. She's not alone.
That's good. You were telling me earlier that when you guys, Jason and his wife are both artists and they're often on the road together, and when you guys are on the road together, you usually have the baby.
Yeah, if Amanda's out on her tour and I'm out on my tour, I take the baby most of the time. Just because I have a safer vehicle for touring. And it's true, you know. When we can, we all go out together. But she just put a record out a couple weeks ago. And she's in a small theater in Louisiana tonight. And she's in a van with a bunch of dudes. So she sends the baby with me. Because I'm in a bus with a nanny.
I've got some songs here that I want to have a very sort of college-y songwriting seminar with you, but because you know, Jason is such a good writer, I thought it'd be actually worthwhile going over some of the words. And I feel like these days it's hard to find songs where the lyrics are really as rich and complex as Jason. But before I do that, I wanted to just sort of go back and set the scene in terms of you becoming a songwriter, in terms of where you came from. You come from a very musically rich place, and how early experiences that you had might have shaped you as a songwriter or determined the fact that you would become a songwriter.
I started out playing different musical instruments with family members, my dad's dad and my dad's brother and my mom's brother, my mom's dad. And all my aunts and uncles on both sides really either played or sang. And my granddad on my dad's side was a Pentecostal preacher. And every Sunday, you know, we would go and eat dinner at their house. And then maybe one Sunday a month, maybe two Sundays a month, his extended family would come. So his brothers and sisters would come. And they all brought instruments. And, you know, that was just how we passed the time as a family, was sitting around playing mostly gospel music and old traditional country songs. They were very religious, very, like, my grandmother had, you know, the long skirts, never wore pants in her life.
Oh, wow.
You know, never took any kind of medication until she was almost dead. She took some ibuprofen, you know.
Oh, she blew it.
She didn't cut her hair. She didn't wear makeup. You know, it was, they were very, very religious, holiness, which is a version of Pentecostal that's not quite snake handling, but, you know, it was serious business. It was very serious. Very, very serious, holy business. And I started out learning those songs, and it was like a childcare thing. My parents both worked, and so when my grandparents lived right next to the high school where I went from kindergarten through 12th grade. Yeah. And so I would walk to their house until my parents got home, and then in the summers I would stay at their house pretty much every day while my parents worked. And to keep me occupied, and you know, also because he just really liked my company for whatever reason, my granddad taught me to play different instruments, and the majority of that was the guitar, because he played banjo, he played fiddle, mandolin, and he called those lead instruments, and then there had to be a rhythm instrument, so I had to play rhythm guitar. It was like a musical boot camp situation. Because this started when I was, you know, 7 years old or so, and he had these huge, the guitars that I play now, big dreadnought, you know, named after the largest boat. It's a big guitar. I couldn't hardly reach around the guitar, and you know, he would give me a hard time, like, you're getting lazy, you know, you're getting lazy.
Yeah.
But there was always a reward at the end of it. If I would go through hours of playing rhythm on these gospel and country songs with him, he would play blues songs for me. He'd put the guitar in his lap, and he would play slide guitar in open tunings.
Cool.
And I always begged him to do that. But before he would do it, I would have to play the Jesus stuff for a couple of hours. he took me when I was probably 10 or 11 years old. He took me to the local record store and bought me the complete Robert Johnson recordings when that came out altogether.
Nice.
But then we get back to the house, and he's got a little cassette player that dubs from one cassette to the other, and so he records all the songs onto a blank cassette that aren't particularly vulgar, you know, all the squeeze my lemon stuff. So he gives me the cassettes of the songs that don't have that stuff on it. And then when I'm like 15, he gives me the original box set. He says, I think you're old enough to handle these songs now. And, you know, it's from the 20s. It's not that racy. And this is 1990. You know, I was already into Nirvana at this point. And
he wasn't, I guess. That's funny. You got a scholarship to the University of Memphis.
I did, yeah.
And while there, you studied creative writing.
Yes.
Fiction writing. Because I think one can see the influence of, we can go to this in a second, but I feel like in your songs, you can see someone that has clearly thought about point of view and narrative and how to tell stories and all this. Would it be fair to say that what you learned from fiction writing actually did make a big difference in your songwriting?
Yeah, very much. That not just what I learned from writing it, but just from the habits of reading that I developed.
Okay.
You know, early on, and then got really intense about while I was in college, and right. I knew I wanted to write better lyrics, so I thought, well, if I study fiction, then I'll be able to write fiction, whether it rhymes or not.
You know? Okay.
And I didn't want to study poetry because, thankfully, I knew at that point that a poet is not just a really good songwriter. It's a completely different thing.
Right.
So different. The microscope is at a completely different diameter at that point, you know.
Yeah.
But I knew that if I read a whole lot and was forced to write a whole lot, then it would make me better with words. And so that's why I studied creative writing.
Yeah. Okay, well, now I just want to jump ahead to one of the songs that you wrote on the album Northeastern, which came out in 2013. Sorry. We're in the north.
I know. It's a windy
Northeastern. Okay. Sorry. I know this. I know it's called Southeastern. I just made a little mistake. And it's very stressful being up here, you know. So I'm going to read the first verse. I'm just going to read. I'm not going to sing. And maybe Jason will sing this song later, but this is a song called Different Days.
It's so weird when somebody reads the lyrics and doesn't sing them.
Do you want to?
No. I would rather you do that. I don't mean it's weird for me.
I'm not going to sing. You know,
when I did the NPR interview, Terry Gross did it, and you're like wearing headphones because you're at a remote location. And it was that moment where like Terry Gross is whispering my lyrics to me right now.
Okay.
This is like smoking on a plane. I've made it.
Well, anyway, okay, Different Days. This is the first verse of Different Days. Staring at the pictures of the runaways on the wall, seems like these days you couldn't run away at all. And even if you did, what you got to run away to, just another drunk daddy with a white man's point of view. So now, staring at the pictures of the runaways on the wall, what's happening in the beginning of this song?
What's
your impulse to write this? How's this song start?
I'm standing at the grocery store. I think it was Walmart. I lived in Alabama at the time, and I didn't go grocery shopping before 2 a.m. At that point in my life. So I'm like, they have this big board of missing and runaway children as you come in and out the door. Before you get to the door greeter, you past the runaway children. And so I'm standing there staring at it, and it just occurs to me, like, how is it possible that you could even run away? Like, how could it seems like anybody could keep up with you, especially if you're a teenage kid who's probably extremely active on social media. Like, how could, and I know this is probably kind of insensitive, but if I'm like a 16-year-old and I'm running away, I'm making it 3 days before I'm on Instagram.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, somebody's going to find me. I'm going to drop a pin accidentally.
1,100 likes.
Yes. but, you know, I'm thinking that. Like, how is it possible? And then most of the kids who do, you know, they have this idea of, I have to get away from these abusive parents or these parents who don't believe the way that I believe. And in my mind, I'm thinking they probably wound up with something much worse or something just like what they were running away from, you know, and that's the ones who really got very lucky and didn't just get picked up and murdered, you know. So that was the songs, they're heavier than I am, probably.
Mm-hmm. How do you know that's a song? How do you know? Are you standing there saying,
because I thought
song.
It was insightful, you know? Like, I stood there and I thought, well, it seems like you couldn't you couldn't even run away at all. And then I thought, that rhymes with wall, and I'm looking at a wall.
That's all it takes?
Yes.
Oh!
That's all that part of it takes. It really takes a lot of riding around and killing time. But the songwriting part, yeah, you just have to pay attention, and you have to stop and go, I'm thinking of a song right now, and I didn't realize it until just now. You know? Like traveling alone. I was literally traveling alone. Right. I was sitting in an airport, and I thought, man, I'm tired of traveling alone. And then I thought, why don't I say that 12 times in a row? And so I'm singing into my cell phone, and there's a guy sitting next to me at the gate, and I like don't want him to know I'm singing into my cell phone, so I'm like doing this. And then I get home and I listen to the memo and it's and I have to figure out that's the bulk of my work is trying to figure out what the hell I was saying into my phone.
Let me just go to the next verse. Because I think the point of view changes a little bit, which is another thing you do in your songs. I can see you in my mind's eye catching light, sleep beside the river if we make it out of town tonight. You can strip in Portland from the day you turned 16. You got one thing to sell and benzodiazepine.
Yes.
Now, rhyming on benzodiazepine is a feat.
Well, thank you.
Good for you.
That's what we call the Loretta Lynn rhyme. When you stumble on one that's just, how do these words rhyme? This is unbelievable. Right. But it's the right
drug.
You
got drug. Day you turn 16 and benzodiazepine.
It falls in there pretty well. I think The Day You Turn was probably the part that had to be manipulated a little bit to get the meter to land just right, you know?
Okay.
Because it would have been more direct to say from 16 or from the age of 16.
Okay.
You know, but when you say The Day You Turn, it drops the meter correctly. And then you also think, well, then this person must be eager to make their own income, even though it may not be you start thinking more things about it. You get deeper into it and think more about the character. But it's the right drug. I mean, that's the miracle of it. It's like, that's what this person would be using.
Would be taking, yeah.
Yeah, and that's not what she has to sell. And I've had people that mistook that. They think I'm saying you have one thing to sell. And that's benzodiazepine, but that's not it.
That's not the one thing she has to sell.
We all know what she has to sell. But the drugs are so she can live with selling it.
But what's happened now in these two verses is you've gone from someone who was looking at this poster on the wall in a Walmart to thinking of yourself as another younger person who might have been a Confederate and run away with this person.
Yeah. There's a shifting narrator that sort of becomes a little bit less trustworthy as it moves along. But, that's what I like about songs as opposed to other kinds of writing. The rules, you can ignore the rules. You know, there's certain rules you can't ignore, but rules of time, rules of tense, rules of point of view are just out the window. And what's true and what's fiction is also out the window. It doesn't matter. They don't put them on the shelves that way. They put books on the shelves that way at Barnes & Noble, but they don't do that at used to be called record
stores.
That's
true. There's no nonfiction or fiction song.
No, there's no nonfiction section for songwriters.
Right. So, but I think we as listeners often think that you are telling the truth.
Of course,
about your life
yes,
and your
always.
Song.
And people don't think Schwarzenegger's the Terminator, but they think that I am always talking about myself.
Well, part of it is we know that your story, your life story, involves stopping drinking, and that this was a big thing for your not only for you but for your songwriting, and your last two albums have had a lot of songs that seem to be about that. And I would say this song, Different Days, is also about
that. Most certainly, yeah.
It's also about that. Do you find that not being public about not drinking, first of all, it kind of cuts out a lot of country songs for you.
Yeah.
You're not going to be singing a lot of songs in bars, probably.
Not a lot.
In the present day.
Not a lot.
I mean, do you feel that was a choice that actually might have alienated some of your fans? Or do you feel like you don't care?
No, I don't. I wouldn't have cared. But no, it didn't. There are people, when I sing Cover Me Up, and I sing the line about swearing off that stuff, being alcohol, people throw their damn drinks up in the air. And I love it. I love the irony of it. I love that it's not lost on them, you know. They just have to do that. They have to, like, you know, roll tide however they can. They have to do it, you know, however they can get that out, even if that means spilling their beer in the name of sobriety on the person standing next to them, you know. And that's the thing. You can't aim songs, you know. You can't aim art, really. Right. If you're trying to make, and my wife says I have to say I'm an artist, so I have to say I'm an artist. But
well, you don't say it enough, really? Or?
I just don't want to say it because, you know, I'm kind of from the school like James McMurtry, where he says, you know, I used to think I was an artist. Turns out I'm a beer salesman. You know, there's a lot of things James McMurtry says that are brilliant. But he's one of the best. Perfect. He's one of the best.
Yeah, he is.
Anytime I'm talking to anybody about drinking and songs, I always bring up that line where he says, I don't want another drink, I just want that last one again. I think that is the fucking cellar door of alcohol songwriting. Right. It's perfect, you know? Yeah. It's perfect. That's the whole problem. You can never have that second or third drink over and over and over and over. And the seventh drink is not just a repeat of the second or third drink. And he made all that go into a line that rhymes and sounds beautiful. He's a genius. Plus, he says the sweetest things, and he can't open his mouth all the way. So it sounds like he hates your fucking guts while he's talking to you. You know, if you come off stage and say, that was a beautiful set. I was really moved by those songs. And he never parts his teeth.
Do you think that your songs, your songwriting, your music changed from when you were drinking to when you were not drinking? Can you see differences in your...
It got a lot better when I quit drinking.
Right.
A lot better. Because... before, I would sit down, I'd get up in the morning, well, not in the morning, I'd get up in the afternoon, and I would be hungover, so I would drink like a pot of coffee, and if I was particularly hungover, I'd take a swig out of the bottle, maybe a couple swigs, maybe more than that, and then I would sit down and start to write a song. So you're looking at probably 2:30 before I actually have a pen in my hand, you know, and I'm sitting down, I'm writing a song, and so from 2:30 to 4:30, you know, I'm dealing with my hangover and I'm trying to come up with good lyrics, and then it's 6:00 and this is the time when everybody gets off work and they're going to be in the bar. And, you know, I was living above a bar and pool hall in Sheffield, Alabama for a long time when I, up until I got sober. That's where I moved out of and went to rehab and then stayed with some friends and then went to Australia with Ryan Adams, of all things to do when you just got sober.
Right.
It turned out to be really good because he had been sober for a few years at that point, and he knew how to occupy your time. But
how do you do that? What do you do?
He's like a 15-year-old, you know. I think a lot of him went back to the person he was when he started doing drugs and drinking in the first place. So, I mean, he's renting out laser tag facilities. And, like, we're going heavy metal record shopping to find the most satanic records we can possibly find. Yes. Pinball all the time. Pinball and cats.
That works.
Yeah. And he had on that tour, he ordered us some keytars. And so we set up on the bus at night. Rather than going out to a bar, we would sit and we would jam on keytars like we were Herbie Hancock in our minds, you know. And this is the kind of stuff he does. It's like, I don't know, it's like he's a kid, and you're like, shit, right. I'll be a kid with you, dude. Let's do that instead of speed balls, you know. But by the time the sun went down, I was done writing for the day. So I would go to the bar, and I would drink for 10 hours, and then it would all start over. Right. And when I quit drinking, it doesn't really matter what you start with. As long as you've got time to edit, You know, and I'm sure you know this, as long as you put the time into it, you're going to wind up writing something good.
Yeah.
You don't have to wait to be inspired. All that is bullshit.
Right.
All that, like Chuck Close says, inspiration's for amateurs. The rest of us just show up and get to work.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah.
And so when I got sober, I just started showing up and getting to work.
Right.
And then instead of going down to the bar when the sun went down, I stayed there with my song. I kept my ass in the chair, and the songs got better. Rather than having two or three great songs and some filler on a record, I had two really, really solid records from start to finish.
Absolutely.
Yeah, thank you. All right.
The New Yorker's John Seabrook. In a moment, we'll hear Jason Isbell playing a couple of those songs from a live show at the New Yorker Festival in 2016. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
She said, Andy, you're better than your past. Winked at me and drained her glass. Cross-legged on a bar stool like nobody sits anymore. She said, Andy, you're taking me home.
Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We just heard a conversation with Jason Isbell, who's made a name for himself as one of the great Americana songwriters who's working today. He comes in the tradition of people like Merle Haggard or Guy Clark. He'll perform two songs now, Different Days and How to Forget.
Of the runaways on the wall. It seems like these days you couldn't run away at all. Even if you did, what you got to run away to? Just another drunk daddy with a white man's point of view. I can see you in my mind's eye catching light. We'll sleep beside the river if we make it out of town tonight. You can strip in Portland on the day you turn 16. You got one thing to sell and benzodiazepine. 10 years ago I might seen you dancing in a different light. And offered up my help in a different way. But those were different days. Those were different days. Had a girl back home and we shared her a single bed. When I whispered in her ear, she believed every word I said. And if she didn't believe, she didn't dare give me slack. It was, baby, I love you, get off of my goddamn back. Then time went by and I left again. Guess Jesus loves a sinner, but the highway loves the sin. My daddy told me, I believe he told me true, that the right thing's always the hardest thing to do. 10 years ago I might have stuck around for another night. Used her in a thousand different ways. those were different days. Those were different days. And the story's only mine to live and die with. And the answer's only mine to come across. But the ghosts that I got scared and I got high with look a little lost. And 10 years ago I might thought I didn't have the right to say the things an outlaw wouldn't say. Those were different days. Those were different days. Those were different days.
Thank you. Is there a way to turn my microphone up? Can we turn my microphone up? I feel like I'm in a Sprite commercial. Can we turn my microphone up? I'll just go ahead and start, and then if it gets louder, I'll just be happier later. I'm going to try this. This is one of those songs I usually need to warm up to sing. But let's just have low expectations. That way we won't be disappointed. Oh, that's my guitar. And it was plenty loud. That guitar is good now. Now the microphone, the other one. Hey, 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 hey. This is me. There we go. Tss. Hey, hey. Great, okay. Give her space, give her speed, give her anything she needs, get her out of here. Give her weed, give her wine, give her anything but time, get her out of here. She won't stop telling stories, and most of them are true. She knew me back before I fell for you. I was straight, I was sad, didn't realize what I had. It was years ago. I was sick, I was scared, I was socially impaired. It was years ago. My past a scary movie, I watched and fell asleep. Now I'm dreaming up these creatures from the deep. Teach me how to forget, replace the character set. Teach me how to unlearn a lesson. Teach me how to forget, 'cause I ain't sorry just yet. Teach me how to unlearn a lesson. Have a seat, have a drink, tell the jury what you think. Was I good to you? Was it hell? Was it fun? Did you think I was the one? Was I good to you? And now that I've found someone who makes me want to live, does that make my leaving harder to forgive? Teach me how to forget,
replace the character set. Teach me how to unlearn a lesson. Teach me how to forget, 'cause I ain't sorry just yet. Teach me how to unlearn a lesson. Teach me how to forget, replace the character set. Teach me how to unlearn a lesson. Teach me how to forget, 'cause I ain't sorry just yet. Teach me how to unlearn a lesson.
Thank you.
Jason Isbell performing Different Days and How to Forget at the New Yorker Festival in 2016. He's touring the country starting in August. Next week, I'll talk about the January 6th committee hearings with Congressman Jamie Raskin of Maryland. I hope you'll join us for that. And to close today, here's Jason Isbell with Speed Trap Town.
She said it's none of my business, but it breaks my heart. I dropped a dozen cheap roses in my shopping cart. Made it up to the truck without breaking down. I guess everybody knows you in a speed trap town. It's a Thursday night, but there's a high school game. I'll sneak a bottle up the bleachers and forget my name. These 5A bastards run a shallow cross. It's a boy's last dream and a man's first law. And it never did occur to me to leave till tonight. When there's no one left to ask if I'm all right. Sleep until I'm straight enough to drive, then decide if there's anything that can be left behind. The doctor said Daddy wouldn't make it a year. Oh, but the holidays are over and he's still here. How long can they keep you in the ICU? See the veins through the skin like a faded tattoo.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Louis Mitchell. This episode was produced by Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Brita Green, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, and Gofen Mputubwele.
Along with Jeffrey Masters, Will Coley, and Michael May. And we had assistance from Harrison Keithline and James Napoli.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
Till tonight, when I realized he'll never be alright. Sign my name and say my last goodbye, then decide.